Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. I'm going to talk today about forgiveness and practicing forgiveness as a part of our practice. I have to admit, I've never been quite sure about forgiveness. I mean, its place in the Buddhist tradition and the Zen tradition, it's not talked about all that much. And, you know, when I look up ancient texts about forgiveness, there aren't that many about that word in particular. It's really hardly ever mentioned. And in the past, I have to admit, I was a little bit suspicious of it. I was asked to give a talk, no, write an article many years ago, 15, 20 years ago, about it for somebody else's newsletter. And I thought, oh, forgiveness, I don't know what I'm going to say about that. And I think I was, thinking back on it, I think I was, the feeling I had was that there's a lot of associations with forgiveness from my Christian background, because in the Christian tradition it's seminal. I mean, it's kind of, in a way, at the heart of things. Personally, but also of the theology that I grew up with. That is to say that, you know, God forgives your sins through Christ. That's the equation. And then if, without Christ, as I remember it, you know, there's not so much of that forgiveness. There's another thing that, and Carol's here. You remember that? That's one of the five. What was it called?
The four spiritual pains.
Four spiritual pains.
The common cold of spiritual pain.
Yeah, and when we did the Living and Dying group, we also went through forgiveness, and the other feeling I had then was that sometimes it feels too much like a set piece, forgiveness, like too structured. You know, will you forgive me? Yes, I forgive you. Okay, we can move on. Like that. And it feels messier to me in real life. Okay. Having said all that, I'm really coming around to forgiveness. I feel it's an important concept. It's certainly one that we talk about, you know, in the West. And I've been considering it more and more in recent years, and I've given a talk on it every January for the last couple of years, because this is our month of renewal, of starting again, and I feel that forgiveness is a kind of starting again, and it's a renewal that I believe can really be helped by our practice. I think there's real aid here to be had from this practice of ours. Okay, so just to break down forgiveness a little bit. I think when it's at play, there's often a wrongdoer, and there's a kind of a debt owed to the wronged party. Just to break it down. There's been something wrong, and the feeling that the person wronged has is owed something. Like, for instance, if I'm on a bus and everything's just fine, and then somebody comes in and they step hard on my foot, you know, maybe they say, oh, pardon me. And then they're, and I say, okay, no problem. And then they're pardoned. That debt is erased. And we're back to neutral with the situation. If they don't say anything, then I'm like, wait, what? I'm owed something here. An apology of some sort. A recognition. And if it's not discharged, if that debt is not discharged, then it, you know, resentment can build up. And maybe if I see that guy on the street, I think, there's the jerk who stepped on my foot. Like, that's who that guy is. And it brings up that, right? I think it's worth remembering that human life is always, we're always crossing each other all the time. I sometimes have to remind myself that because, you know, this is not a perfect little life we have. It's messy. We're always doing this. There's always little debts incurred and little problems that are unsolved. We're always annoying each other. And I think it's possible for resentments to pile up. That is a possibility in our life. But then, forgiveness is kind of a discharging of that resentment and of the debt and of the charge that's around it. It doesn't mean, and it can happen whether the guy says I'm sorry or not. The guy who stepped on my foot. It doesn't necessarily mean it's dismissing the action as just fine. It's not okay to step on somebody's foot, but it is discharging the charge around it. And for me, and this is what I kind of want to focus on, there's many areas that I or anybody else could talk about when it comes to forgiveness, but I think that one thing that helps a great deal and that I think about in my practice, whether it's around forgiveness or not, or something else, is seeing somebody else as larger than you normally see them. I think that's part of our practice, also seeing ourselves as larger than we normally see ourselves. And I was listening to a podcast by a podcast called Philosophy Bites on, and there was a professor there from the University of San Diego who specializes in, one of her specialties is forgiveness. She was from South Africa, and she that was one of the reasons that she took that on. And she said kind of a similar thing. She said that in order to forgive, one has to see beyond the hurt that person has inflicted, to see that person as more than just the hurter. I think when we have been wronged, our view of somebody narrows very quickly. We see them as that person who has wronged. And that's kind of all I see is that jerk who stepped on my foot. And, you know, I don't know that he maybe has troubles himself, or maybe his parents were unkind to him. Or maybe he volunteers at the animal shelter. So that we ourselves, I think, become more than just we. Yeah. So the other person, just focusing on the other person for a second, I think that there's a nice quote from Longfellow that I've often thought of when regarding somebody else and trying to see them as more than just one-dimensional. If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. To start to imagine that, the Dalai Lama suggests you imagine your enemies as children, for instance. What was it like for them as children? And then, somewhere in here I might have Martin Luther King quote, which has really meant a lot to me over the years. Here he is faced with, you know, what was the guy's name? Bull somebody, you know, Bull Connor, right? The sheriff, you know, who's just savaging these protesters. And he's telling his people, don't take the easy route with this. You have to learn to see these people differently and more broadly than we automatically do. He says we have to recognize the evil deed of the enemy or the neighbor, the thing that hurts, never quite expresses all that he is. An element of goodness can be found in even our worst enemy. Each of us has a schizophrenic personality, tragically divided against ourselves. A persistent civil war rages within all of our lives. Something within us causes us to lament with Ovid, the Latin poet, I see and approve the better things, but must follow the worse. Or to agree with Plato that human personality is like a charioteer, having two headstrong horses, each wanting to go in a different direction, or to repeat with Apostle Paul, the good that I would do, I do not, but the evil I would not, that I do. This simply means that there is good in some in the worst of us, and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we're less prone to hate our enemies. Those words totally work for me. To be able to see people in a broader way. And also to see ourselves as more than just victims. So that we get out of that victim-perpetrator dynamic. I think Zazen helps with this. In Zazen, we're asked to stop, to put everything down, to let go of all of our loves and all of our hates, temporarily. Not forever, but for a moment. And that means putting down. You know, the Buddha has one nice line kind of that's very close to forgiveness, which is that holding on to resentment is like holding on to a hot coal. You know, it's you that gets burned. So put it all down. And that takes time and practice, and we get to know ourselves through that practice. But when we do, to the extent that we can, the feeling I have, and this is one of the reasons I'm coming back to forgiveness in the last few years, is I have a feeling of forgiveness. I just have a feeling that everything's forgiven when I'm quiet and just after that. That I've made mistakes, that other people have made mistakes, and that it's okay. Now that feeling doesn't last. We come back to our ledger, we come back to everything. But for a moment there, and that's the feeling I have, is that, you know, God has, like, we all have God's forgiveness then, at that moment. In Hakuin's Song of Zazen, he says, those who do Zazen even once wipe away beginningless crimes. And that's a wild claim, of course. But there's some truth in it, that temporarily, for a moment, everything's wiped clean. And that's something that we don't all, that doesn't exist really in common life. We're always one thing and the next thing and the next thing, and we're juggling this, that, and the other, and the debts are piling up over here, and it just clears everything. It has that possibility. When we come back, then the ledger reappears. But having done Zazen, I think there's a better chance that we see beyond the narrow scope. That we see, that we have a wider view, more than just the person who stepped on our foot. That person there's a possibility that that person is more than just the person who stepped on their foot, the person who walks very nicely, out there in the distance when I notice him, that interacts with other people in a way that doesn't seem evil. So I think that this practice really does give us a chance if we go with it. And I think it doesn't happen automatically. When we sit in quiet and release everything, when we come back, I think we still have to do these practices of thinking about that person, thinking about what they might be going through. And none of it is automatic. It's not as if we just get to forgive the person quickly or easily or what have you. It's a subtle art. It's a subtle business with a lot of different competing emotions, but I think zeroing out gives us a chance, whether it's with problems in our lives, whether it's with other people in our lives, to see things fresh, to see things differently than we normally do. And in particular, when people have wronged us, it gives us a chance to see something besides the sharp end of that person, to see a wider view. Okay, so I also think that there's an axiom in Buddhism that nudges us toward starting again with people. So there's this Zazen practice that we do, and I've asked you to, also think after that. So go with it. But also there's something else I want to discuss, and I just want to tell a quick story. It's not a quick story. It's a long story. So settle in. I think it's important to remember that there's always a chance with people. That no matter what their crimes, our tradition says that that there's a chance. And in a way, they have to be given a chance. Now, how that manifests, we have to be careful and this, that, and the other. We have to be smart. I don't mean that in a crazy way. But I think that everybody has to be given a chance in a certain way. Where I was trained, it was very strict. The rule in the monastery, and this goes back to Japan as well, if you can come and if you can obey the rules within the monastery, then you can stay. And it doesn't matter how many crimes you committed. It doesn't matter whether what your past is. You can be here. You can start again. So I'm going to tell a story of Angulimala. This is a great one. I was thinking about telling it to the kids, but you'll see why not, why I didn't. So Angulimala was the son of King Kosala's Brahmin chaplain. So he was the son of a Brahmin, high Brahmin. And when he was a boy, he was sent to a Brahmin guru to train. And he did great. He was a very good student, excelled, became the guru's best and favorite student. And over time, as sometimes happens, the other students got jealous of him. And they hatched a plot. So they somehow arranged that it looked like Angulimala had slept with the guru's wife and was going around saying, I'm better than the guru. Well, the guru really believed this, and he was furious. He was so angry. He wanted to kill Angulimala. But he didn't, because he thought that might be bad for the bad press. So he tells him, go out. This is your Angulimala. You are my disciple. This is your final task. Go out and kill 100 people. And he figures, this will, this he'll meet his end if he does this. Go out and kill 100 people and bring me back a finger from each one as proof that you've done it. So Angulimala is a good student, and so he goes out, he's diligent, and he kills a lot of people. And he cuts off their finger and he keeps them in a bag, cloth bag, that he puts up in a tree, you know, like you do when you're camping at night. But what happened was the birds started to peck at the bag of fingers. And so he had to come up with a different plan. So he strung the fingers with a string and made a necklace of them and put them around his neck. So he walked around with these fingers around his. And Angulimanga, Anguli means finger, and malas, like the malas that we wear, a necklace, right? So it's a finger necklace. So he's walking around with these fingers on it. And he's, so he's got 99. He's got 99 fingers, and he's looking for his 100th. And a lot of stuff happens then, because then the king finally says, we got to get this guy. I don't know what took him so long. But so he sends out a party to kill Angulimanga. And the mother hears about this, and she, even though he's been such a problem, she wants to go save him. And so she goes out. And at the same time, the Buddha hears of it, and he goes, heads in his direction. And the mother and the Buddha meet at the same time, Angulimanga, Angulimala. And Angulimala, they say, would have killed his mother, but the Buddha was right there and looked, so he chose him to kill for his 100th. And the Buddha just starts walking, and Angulimala chases him as fast as he can, and the Buddha just keeps walking peacefully. And in, at least in one section of the story, no matter how fast he runs, Angulimala, he can't catch the Buddha, even though the Buddha's just strolling along. And so then famously he says, Angulimanga says, monk, stop! And the Buddha just keeps walking and he says, monk, stop, I say! And he's perplexed because the Buddha just seems so peaceful and so calm and not afraid of him at all. And then he yells out, he says, why don't you stop when I tell you to stop? And the Buddha says, Angulimala, I stopped a long time ago. I have been stopped for a long time. It is you who have not stopped. And Angulimala says, what do you mean? And the Buddha says, I have stopped creating unwholesome actions. I have stopped striving in that way. You should also stop. And so Angulimala falls to his knees and he says, it's too late. I've committed too many wrongs, too many crimes. And the Buddha says, no, it's not too late. I'll take you in to our community and you can become a monk. And you can start your life anew. Now, the king catches up to the scene, but he sees what's happened and he's happy not to have to deal with it himself. So the Buddha takes him under his wing and shaves his head. And this part of the story, you know, these stories, sort of, they got lots of add-ons and things like that. But later, Angulimala comes across this young woman. There was a young woman who is having a hard labor, and the Buddha sends Angulimala to be with her and says to ease her pain. And the Buddha says that Angulimala should tell him, I don't have that page, should tell her, since I have been born, I have not committed any crimes, and that will help ease your pain. You know, somehow that merit. And Angulimala says, I can't say that. That's not true. And he says, well, yeah, it is true. Since you've been born a monk, you have not committed any crimes. Mm-hmm. So say that, and that will be. And whatever that phrase is, that's still said, they said, in Theravadan countries to help women in childbirth. That same phrase from Angulimala. So it does help him, and she has a good birth. help her, and it has a good birth. She has a good birth. It's not always easy for Angulimala. When he's out on begging rounds, people, you know, remember who he was and throw things at him and beat him up and almost to the edge of death. And the Buddha says, just take that with composure, because you have a lot of karma you have to work through. That's just the way it works. I think he dies a peaceful death within the monastery, within the Sangha. So that's the story of Angulimala. Stuck. And I mention that because I think that there is a recognition in Buddhism and in Zen that we can start again. That no matter what has happened, we can start again. And of course we have to deal with our old stuff and past, but it helps very much to wipe the slate clean for a moment so that we can start again. And next week, we'll with the chanting, we'll do the Sangye chant, which is a kind of confession that all of our unwholesome karma and then a vow to begin again.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.